how do armies actually fight in fantasy settings? Basically, welcome to our spec fic.
Look, what I learned from Braveheart is arrows cost money. The dead cost nothing. Send in the Irish.
Live from the Mundangerous Command Tent in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 233 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're growing our beards and writing letters home, because we're going to fantasy war. But first, the party witnesses an historic event in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, the field general leads from the front, or at least from the middle, in the Character Creation Forge. Shane, I'm glad we're going to fantasy war, because it seems like America might be going to actual war.
Yeah, so. No, I know. The timing of this is slightly unfortunate.
Yeah. Unintentional.
All right. This episode is brought to you by Cobalt Press. Do you love Cobalt Press 5th Edition Adventures?
Oh, yeah.
Well, now you can get some of their best on fantasy grounds.
Like Courts of the Shadow Fae, which is an adventure for 7th to 10th level characters that contains 100 NPCs, a map with more than 60 locations of the courts and more than 40 combat and role-playing encounters.
Courts of the Shadow Fae takes you from the mortal world to the Heart of Shadow.
Or there's Necropolis of the Mailed Fist, a punishing one-session tournament dungeon for 8th-level characters.
Monsters and constructs guarding the Necropolis can overwhelm the careless or unwary. The traps and hazards protecting its relics can slay an adventurer who makes a single misstep. Curses are everywhere, along with dangers that can destroy magic items.
That's actually the most terrifying part, is destroying magic items.
Oh, yeah, no, bring a one-shot character.
Right? Dragon, sure, I'll fight a dragon. A rust monster, never mind. I'm closing this door and leaving.
Yeah, hard pass.
8th level is actually really nice for this, too, because like, you have abilities, but you're not impervious.
Right.
All right, so everything you need to play is loaded up and ready to go in a sleek virtual table.
So find out more at fantasygrounds.com and tell them DSPN sent you. So Ishan, where are we in the Gates of Morning campaign?
The Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morning Glory campaign. And on the Day of Morning, along a barren stretch of a Carnathy battlefield, the party is fighting for their lives.
So we've blasted through the undead lines, and along with a group of refugees and a squad of Ondarian soldiers, we have taken refuge inside a House Jurasco Enclave. That's the halfling mark of healing.
Yep, now they're technically neutral in the war, as are all the other dragon-marked houses, but the party has been able to convince Wilmo, the Enclave's leader, to shelter them at least for a little while. So the group rests for a short time in these very peaceful environs. Like, this is an enclave of the House of Healing, and typically when it's not basically 2 miles away from a massive battlefield, it's a place where people will come to convalesce, and you know, they like stroll through gardens and rehabilitation rooms, and you know, there are spas and baths around. Right now though, there isn't really anyone being healed other than the refugees in the party. So halflings tend to their wounds, and then you can see in the distance they're sort of like tending to like medicinal herbs.
Until Wilmo asks us to join her at the top of the Enclave Tower to witness something strange.
They climb several hundred feet up to this tower, the tallest structure in the entire Enclave, and they can see all around the Enclave, like right on the perimeter, the Carnathy undead that they were able to escape have now followed them and are gathered around. They're milling about, almost like they're nervous. But they don't cross the arcane glyph that marks the limit of the property.
And then Lenore spies a commotion far to the south, above Metrol, the capital of Seer. There is a gout of flame that must be hundreds of feet high, jetting up from the ground, and then small flying figures begin to circle high in the air above the city.
And then, as they all watch in horror, the entire nation of Seer, which is basically all of the land to the south of them, evaporates in a flash of light that blinds both Lenore and Decimus.
And the entire Enclave begins to shake. The ground splits open and unleashes terrible arcane energies, and the whole compound is engulfed in miasmic gases and necromantic surges.
Outside the edge of the compound, all of the Carnathi undead massed outside collapse as one, destroyed in what seems to be the wake of like this arcane surge coming from Seer. The compound is also destroyed, and the massive tower that they are all standing on crumbles beneath their feet.
Yeah, tower falls, everyone dies. And that's how we spent the day of mourning.
And we'll find out what happens next week.
So this week, we are going to talk about fantasy warfare. So we should start with a disclaimer here. Neither of us served in the military, and especially not in the medieval military. And we are also not military historians. So the objective here isn't to make RPGs true to life. The objective is to make RPGs true to fiction.
Yeah, because we've read a lot of military fiction.
Yeah, exactly.
And we've read a lot of fantastical military fiction.
Yeah, and like it's a big theme, right? Like that's the whole kind of thing behind D&D, right? Is like it started from tabletop war games, and then it became, okay, I don't care about this whole squad of people. I only care about this one person, right?
Right, and like, be honest, people who want more military in their fantasy aren't usually, like, if they're honest with themselves, saying, I want it to be just like actually being on the battlefield, right?
Right.
It's like, all right, I know people who've actually been in the military and they play a lot of D&D and they're like, I don't want it to be exactly the same because yeah. Like, I didn't really enjoy that experience. I'm playing this because it's fantasy.
Right. Also, like, especially in this period, like being in the military meant that you were conscripted from your farm that you didn't own, that you worked for the local lord, right? Because it was feudal. Then you were basically handed a pike, and then you were told to march for miles and miles on end with poor supplies, like poor rations. And then at some point, you would line up in a big line. And then run at another group of people and probably die. And if you didn't, you got paid like one coin for it, and then you got sent back to your home, hopefully back to your family.
So yeah, it's basically only war. That's the most realistic
exactly.
Medieval fantasy war.
So I think what we want to do here, kind of talk about, you know, given that war is a common theme, how do armies actually fight in fantasy settings? Like, basically, welcome to our spec fic.
Look, what I learned from Braveheart is arrows cost money. The dead cost nothing. Send in the Irish. All right. So in order to sort of get into the nitty gritty of this, usually in fantasy war, you're moving, like, it's a high level, right? You're moving units rather than necessarily single individuals, right?
Yeah. And I think, like, when we think of, like, the epic Game of Thrones battle, right? Or like even going back to like Troy, right? Or something in that period, like the Hellenistic period is still very much like, I think, in the realm of like D&D warfare.
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah.
Right. So like when you think about that, like you need to think about like what kinds of troops are involved in the battle. And then like how do commanders of the time use those troops? So, like, starting with infantry, which is, of course, people on foot, you've got your, like, rank-and-file troops. They're, you know, the barely trained peasants who have pikes or spears that are marching because of fealty to a lord and not because they really want to be there.
Right. On the other side, often enemies, you'll have, you know, just hordes of orcs and goblins who are poorly armed and poorly armored. Of course, you might also be leading these particular troops, too, depending. Yeah,
exactly. They're there to, like, do the bulk of the fighting and most of the dying.
Right, the abstracted fighting and then maybe abstracted dying.
Right. And then I think you also have, like, an elite tier of your infantry as well, right? Like, these are the professional soldiers, the adventurers, you know, like, sort of the more terrifying monsters, right? The ogres or giants, right? Like, they're more powerful. They're there to, like, reinforce the troops so they don't break morale and flee. They take on the most difficult or specialized missions. Like, they're the ones who are responsible for, like, you know, make sure that the castle gate is open, right? Or make sure that the castle gate doesn't open.
Right. Yeah, I think the Lord of the Rings movies actually did a good job of this, showing different types of, like, orcs and goblins. And, you know, so they're in the Mines of Moria, and there's hordes of goblins, and, oh, no, okay, it's small, but they've got pointy bits, and, like, they're definitely going to overwhelm us. And then what happens? In comes the cave troll, the elite. Uh-huh.
They have a cave troll.
Right. Okay, great. Let's kill that one first, or do we just run? I think we run away.
Right. A lot of times, I think in the real world, like the professional soldiers became like the commanders of these different companies, right? So you would have a professional soldier leading a rabble of conscripts.
Yeah, and it's interesting. If you do want to modernize this a little bit, these days, armies are basically professional. So right. The skill level of a professional soldier in medieval times is probably what you're getting from even just line infantry these days.
Right. Of course, we also tend not to just line up on two sides of a battlefield and run at each other. So
yeah, hopefully like, not.
It's a little different these right. days.
Fix bayonets.
Right.
So not everyone runs on foot.
No, you also have cavalry, which were sort of the truly terrifying troops of the medieval period. These are your knights on horsebacks, your orcs on wargs, you know, your mounted combatants. They might even be flying mounted combatants, right?
Yeah.
But they have, they're quick, they're maneuverable, they have a big advantage versus infantry.
Right, this is your Pegasus troops, right? Your Nazgul.
Yeah, I mean, anyone mounted on a dragon.
That's everybody. It's everybody.
Well, ideally.
This is dragon fighting.
Right. A lot of times they're tasked with flanking or harassing troops. You know, they tend to have that big advantage, and you basically want to put them in a place where they get the most value out of that. So it's always better, like, if you have a line of pikemen, like, you want to attack them from the side so they're not able to set their pikes against you. You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can kite, right? You do ride by attacks or fly by attacks. Of course, cavalry, no matter what kind, should be looking out for the archers.
Uh-huh.
In medieval times, this usually means longbows, which actually will mean trained troops who know what they're doing, who stay really far back, away from the front lines and just rain death from above.
Yeah, so typically, right, this is always the heel turn for one side or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But once the infantry are engaged, right, like once the two lines from either side have met, you stop shooting your arrows because you don't want to kill your own men. But of course, the evil side will invariably say, keep firing, and then just kill everybody.
Right. Sir, we'll hit our own men.
Do it.
You can also get a, like, infantry version or like a rabble conscripted peasant version of archers if crossbows are available, because those require much less skill to actually wield.
Yeah, but they don't have the distance typically.
That's
right?
True. Like, and they're expensive.
Yeah, like they're a lot harder, like certainly in medieval times, and again, like a fantasy world, like whatever, right? Money is always fungible in fantasy worlds, and magic is a thing, so like you certainly could have that, but I think the main thing is you just want to be blindly shooting into the air as many arrows as you can, and cause as much pain and death as you possibly could.
Well, I don't think arrows are the way to cause as much pain and death from the air as you can.
Well, are you referring to artillery?
I think I might be.
Okay. So in the modern era, of course, these are like long-range explosives, typically, you know, bombs and cannons and things like that. But in the fantasy period, this is more like catapults or trebuchets or ballista, which are sort of just weapons of fear, right, in a lot of ways. But also you have like offensive mages, right? Your evoker wizard, your fire sorcerer, even like if you have a dragon, your dragon is probably behaving more as artillery mm-hmm. than as like cavalry, right? Like they're strafing the battlefield with massive like cones of fire breath and just melting the troops.
Right. And not typically focused on anyone in particular, right? Like you said, just strafing. Just
right.
being like, all right, I'm going to make a pass. I'm going to hit whoever I happen to hit.
Right. I want to hit as many as possible.
Mm-hmm. And this is one thing that I think we both really like about Eberron is it's really grounded in like the last war, which only ended a few years ago. But it applies magic logically to warfare. So your artillery often was either like something created by an artificer, like some sort of like magical catapult or ballista, or it really just was like, let's send out two mages and they're just casting fireball.
Yeah. So that's interesting because, like, a normal ballista, right, like, isn't really a troop weapon because it's not accurate enough to kill troops individually, and it doesn't fire often enough to make a huge impact, right? Like, same with, like, a trebuchet or a catapult. Like, those are more siege weapons.
Right, knocking down walls.
Right.
Right, you can't move your city out of the way.
Exactly. So you bring them in case there are walls that you need to deal with, right, and you assemble them as you need them. But, like, in Eberron, like, we just kind of had that first adventure involved an arcane ballista, which shot at troop mowing down speed. It was basically a machine gun, right?
Right, a fireball machine gun.
Yeah, and so that's kind of the, like, that's where you get magic involved, where those things can literally do devastating damage. They can be real weapons of shock and awe. They can break morale long before they, like, eliminate every last soldier.
Yeah. In lower magic settings, this can just be the wizard, right? There is a wizard.
Yes, exactly. And having a wizard is enough often to decide you don't want to present combat today.
Right. They're calling down lightning bolts.
They have the weather on their side.
Right. Can't control the weather. Actually, it turns out they can.
Well, so let's talk about that. So I think the last tier of kind of troops to consider are support units, right? So that includes sort of the traditional historical troop support, which are your medics, your drummers and buglers, your priests, right? Like the people who are responsible for conveying information across the battlefield, as well as, like, tending to the wounded or the dying.
Don't overlook these troops at all. One, they're going to be underfoot, so, you know, if artillery is just, you know, dropping heavy fire or there's a rain of arrows, there's just as much chance that a medic or, like, the drummer boy gets hit.
Right.
You know, and those are, like, meaningful things that happen. But at the same time, like, I always love, like, that image and even just the mechanical difficulty of, you know, having the standard bearer, right? Like, I don't have a shield because I'm holding onto a giant flag.
Yeah.
And that's important. And am I taking negative? Sure, but the whole army is getting bonuses from this.
Exactly. And, like, that's important for morale reasons, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the regiment's colors are sort of that point of pride and like, that sort of the way that, like, armies counted coup, even into, like, the Napoleonic era, right? But then also, like, they're incredibly important for commanders because you need to know, like, what units are where. Mm-hmm. Like, which company is down there? Which regiment is down there? Are those, like, the stern and trustworthy Hessians, or are those the flighty and unreliable Irish? You know, is that a company of Scottish Highlanders, or is that a company of, like, conscripted peasants?
Right. And, you know, in, like, the Trojan War, you don't have a spyglass. You can't, like, you know, peer down from, like, a nearby mountaintop. You need to see flags.
Right, exactly. And then likewise, like, you know, if those colors fall, the troops of that regiment don't know where to rally, mm-hmm. right? They don't know where they're supposed to be, and they might just lose morale. They might break when they see their colors fall or if they can't find their colors on the field.
Mm-hmm. This is actually one of my favorite moments in, like, fiction or a game, is someone's like, I drop my shield, or, like, I drop my weapons, forget this, and I lift the standard. That's what I do.
I mean, we immortalized that at, like, the Battle of Iwo Jima, right?
Iwo Jima, yeah. Uh-huh.
Like, it wasn't a standard, it was the American flag, but still, like, that the flag has meaning to the troops fighting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, in fantasy, it's, like, mythical meaning, like, magical meaning to the troops who are fighting.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of that, in a fantasy game, right, a lot of support is going to be magical. You have actual, like, healers who, like, the medic may actually just, like, knit bones together.
Yeah, or mass cure wounds.
Right. But you can also have, like, defensive mages who are casting illusion spells or, like, creating trenches out of thin air, just, like, digging them immediately, you know, throwing up walls of stone.
Right. Or like, you know, abjuration wizards are there to cast magical protection, right? Like, so if you have two relatively untrained groups of troops, the ones who have slightly higher magical AC tend to be the ones who win that fight.
Yeah, I love, again, like, it's an Eberron scenario where you basically have an artificer embedded with the troop who is basically maintaining the shields.
Yeah, exactly.
Or like the magical shields. It's almost like ship-to-ship combat in space.
Right. And then another important thing for magical support is, of course, counterspell. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, that's sort of the excuse to have your... Like, range is the reason that your mages wade into combat at all. They have to stay in range to get their spells useful. But counterspell is the way that your mages protect your troops. So you have to get a little bit closer. That puts some of your most valuable targets, your most valuable soldiers at risk. Mm-hmm. And opens up targets for, say, an enterprising young band of adventurers looking to make a name for themselves.
Who suddenly confront the enemy general, and now everyone makes way.
Exactly.
All right, so we've gotten into this a little bit, but let's talk about tactics.
Okay, so let's talk about, like, sort of the simple medieval fictional tactics. I have no idea if this is how armies actually fought, but that's how they fight in my mind, and that's what we're going with. So you basically, like, you know, you have two armies on either side of a battlefield. They present each other. The infantry lines up on either side, right? This is your, like... ranks and files. You know, there's like six rows of troops arrayed. You might have like a commander on horseback riding along the line, shouting at the men, you know, words of wisdom or inspirational messages or whatever it is, right? And then behind them, you have your rows of archers who are sitting with the artillery and just trying to soften up the enemy as soon as they start to advance. And so, you know, you have your drum start and your bugles call and your leaders call, and everybody starts moving forward towards each other, kind of slowly and marching in step, right? As they get pelted with arrows, hopefully holding up their shields. And eventually you get to like, I don't know, like 30 yards, 50 yards, and then each side charges, right? And it's both sets of soldiers running straight at each other with weapons and crashing into each other, right? This is the blood and the guts and the dying face down in the mud, and you're hitting one person with a shield and getting run through with a spear and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, this is like all of the combat passages in the Iliad.
Exactly.
Which is almost like, it's so much just spear goes through the bottom of someone's tongue and then like into someone's eye, and then this person's brain explodes, you know? Like, it's the hand-to-hand fighting.
Right. It's the senseless and pointless and uncontrolled fighting.
Right.
Right. It is the battle of wills as much as it is the battle of arms. And then once you get everybody engaged in this big nasty scrum, like, that's when you have cavalry streaming in, right? Like, that's when they attack from the sides, or they flank around into the archers, or they do whatever. Like, this is where the trick happens, invariably in the film, that the unit you didn't know was there now comes in from an odd angle, and tips the battle in one side's favor.
This is where the party's plan comes to fruition, right?
Right.
Or, okay, we're charging, or they're charging. Now we phalanx, right? Now we turtle.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you could do it, you should phalanx.
Oh, yes.
it takes a lot of work and a lot of training. Like, you would love to fight as, like, the Myrmidons and their little, like, turtle shield, right? Like, but... Good luck doing it if you're a peasant who just picked up his pike and marched 600 miles to be here.
That's why we have the puppet master telepath.
Yeah, exactly. So, speaking of flanking, right? Like, commanders are always focused on their flanks. Like, they typically have like a left, a right, and then the main strength is in the middle. And they always want to make sure that they're not getting blindsided by an attack from some unexpected direction where their troops aren't really like set up to take the battle. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea being like, if six people run up to one person, that person dies. But if six people run up to six people, you have a chance.
Right. So commanders are always making a determination about which flank is the most vulnerable and then maneuvering their best troops to put them on the most vulnerable flank. Of course, that means then that's not your most vulnerable flank. Your right. Other flank that was not the most vulnerable is now.
Exactly. But like, you know, they're always looking to like, I want to put my most reliable troops in the place where I don't want to have to think about it. You know, like, I want to make sure that like, My dwarven elites are over there on my right flank so that I never have to worry about what's happening over there, because I know they'll carry the day.
Right. Dwarven defenders hold the line, so I put them on the bridge.
Exactly.
So what does make a flank vulnerable?
So I think wide open terrain is one of them. This makes it easy for cavalry maneuvers. It makes it vulnerable to archers for longer. It, you know, like artillery becomes a problem. If it's wide open over there, you got to make sure you've got enough troops to hold it if you get thoroughly attacked.
Mm-hmm. A flank could just be vulnerable because it is difficult to hold. Maybe that is terrain. It could also be that, you know, troops are confined and aren't able to maneuver very well.
Yeah, like, you know, on our right, to our front is desert. To our right is quicksand. Like, it might be harder to fight in quicksand.
And this is where, like, the fantasy elements come into play, right? Like, in real life, if there's quicksand on your flank, probably people aren't attacking from that way. Or at least certainly the cavalry aren't. But right. If they're on phantom steeds, great, they're coming right across the quicksand.
Yeah, exactly. Or, like, you know, you might completely ignore that flank because you know they can't march through quicksand. Or you might completely ignore that forest because you know the Germans can't put tanks through that forest.
But the elves can.
Right. Basically do the opposite of the French in every move. And then I think the other thing that commanders look at is, like, if I lose this flank, what happens to my army, right? So if holding the right side of the line, if the enemy takes that, would they have an advantageous position on the rest of my army? Like, would they have high ground or cover or something like that where we wouldn't be able to win the day? Well, then that instantly, like, that becomes their most attractive target. Therefore, I need to defend it most heavily.
Everybody knows you can't overcome high ground.
Exactly.
Unless you're Obi-Wan.
Right.
So we've already been doing this a bit, and I think this is probably one of the main reasons why we don't try to stick solely to, like, verisimilitude when we're talking about medieval combat, but you need to consider how magic changes all of this and all of these considerations.
Yeah, and the first and most, I don't know, I think obvious one is there's just going to be more meat for the grinder here, right? Like, if an entire company can be wiped out by a single spell or a single dragon's breath, like, good night. The losses will be substantial.
Yeah, because, like, a regular soldier is still on a medieval level, but when you introduce, you know, fireballs and dragons, you're basically talking about the fantasy equivalent of modern weaponry.
Yeah, exactly. Like, call in an airstrike and see what that does to your company of pikemen.
Right.
Like, they don't have a chance, you know?
And, you know, something traditional fantasy like D&D has so many area of effect spells because they're usually focused on, like, attacking two or three big bad monsters.
Right.
But if you, like, do the math on those areas, a fireball can wipe out a whole company.
Yeah. And it's not clear to me, right, how you would necessarily change your tactics because of that. Like, you can't simply spread out further, right? Like, if you spread out your rank and file, well, then anybody mounted is going to decimate your troops anyway. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to keep tight ranks to protect against the, like, mortal threats that face you. You need to find other ways to deal with the supernatural threats.
Right, and that might be having supernatural threats on your side as well.
Exactly.
Geeking the mage.
Exactly.
Right? Shoot the guy in the robes. Or I think this is a pretty common trope, is, like, only the bad guys have magic.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they have the dragons, they have, like, you know, two terrible wizards or sorcerers. And this is basically where you pull out your adventuring party.
Exactly. Also keep in mind, like, you have supernatural fear and magical fear that becomes a factor here in addition to just the normal horror of warfare. So even the hardest and most veteran soldiers could break under those terms.
Right. Anybody can fail a saving throw. But it's not all bad for the line troops, because magic can also strengthen them. You'll get magical enhancements, like on your weapons and your armor. Magical defenses and healing are going to reduce the value of having high quality equipment or training.
Mm-hmm.
It helps to fight if you know that if you can just get through this battle and your side can win, you are going to get healed back basically to, like, full health tomorrow.
Right.
Then yeah, you'll keep pushing through. Okay, I got stabbed in the shoulder, or like, you know, in the gut. A gut wound in, like, the real world meant you were definitely going to die, and you were going to die poorly.
Oh, like any wound meant you were going to die and die poorly because it was going to be gangrene, right?
Infection was going to be terrible unless you got it lopped off properly.
Right.
But yeah, if you know that there's a medic back at the tent who can like heal you and send you back to your farm, you'll fight all the harder.
Mm-hmm. And then likewise, like if you are a good soldier already, like that type of magical aid and enhancement can turn you into like a juggernaut yourself. Right. So you might have like a group of elite knights might be further elitened, I guess, by having like, you know, magical weapons and magical armor and like those types of protections, and might even have like a mage riding with them to continually provide that.
Right.
They might be that much harder to take down.
Yeah, this is up and down the line. Like you might end up in basically a magical tank, or like Eberron has the Warforged Colossi now, where you're probably just pulling levers and pushing buttons.
Right.
But a regular peasant who gets their hands on Excalibur is still going to wreck shit.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's because, you know, Excalibur rules.
Right, yeah.
I think magic also introduces the idea of, like, these ever-shifting battlefields, like, physically shaping the terrain to their will.
Right, we mentioned Wall of Stone, but you can make walls of flame that suddenly appear underneath people's feet.
Right, walls of force. Like, imagine, like, just throwing up a wall of force in front of the enemy mage, and his fireball only goes 30 feet, and now hits himself.
Yep.
Got him.
You can turn stone into mud, or essentially quicksand. You can change the weather quickly and drastically.
Yeah, I mean, like, any of, like, web or entanglement, like, even those low-level spells can, like, can just win your win your squad their battle, right? Because that's enough of an advantage in the maelstrom around you.
Yeah, I think people, to use, like, a D&D example, I often see people being like, why is control weather an 8th-level spell? I don't really get it. But a single spell can turn any battlefield into Russia in the winter.
Uh-huh. Yeah, like you might start on a nice and sunny day, and it might become like a very, very terrible storm, followed by a literal hurricane, followed by Russian winter, all in the course of a couple minutes.
Right. What happened to the Armada? Oh, it sank.
Right. Tsunami.
I sank it. How many battles have been turned by weather? So many historically. All right, so with magic in play, intelligence is basically everything.
Yeah, we haven't even mentioned, like, the possibility of illusion yet, right? We had that actually in one of our games where one of the, in our Dark Sun game, where the, like, mercenary company's, like, master wizard used illusion to misrepresent our troop quality.
Yeah, think about even simple things like disguise self as the enemy general.
Mm-hmm.
Or disguise voice, right? Like, I don't need to look like you. I just need to sound like you as my voice booms out across the battlefield, giving you orders.
Well, that's the thing, too. It's like just simple things like thaumaturgy, right? Like, you can now relay orders much easier. Like, you have multiple ways to fall back. Like, if you're, you know, if you can't hear the drums and you can't hear the bugles, like, you might just hear a magically enhanced voice in your head from your leader telling you exactly where to go or what to do.
Yeah, feints, all of these kinds of tricks. Think how much maneuverability teleport adds and how much you need to consider that if you know that your enemy can teleport.
Right. You know, what looks like the weakest side of your formation might actually be, like, under an illusion and there's twice as many troops there as you're able to see.
Or when you crash into them, it turns out that was a cliff.
Yeah. Or, like, the other one that I really like is, like, because it's relatively simple and low level. It's just, like, make a disorganized rabble appear to be, like, elite shock troops, right? Like, you don't want to engage these guys because they look bad. But instead, like, all you've done is put, like, one lousy company over there. They weren't going to do anything in the battle anyway. Because the goal here is to force your opponent into making a mistake and then, you know, capitalize on that mistake.
All right. So, in addition to troops, you often have high-level champions who take the battlefield, especially in, like, ancient forms of combat.
Yeah, these are your named characters with plot armor. And that plot armor is very important, because this is not how real armies fight.
Or, well, this is how real kings sometimes died.
Well, right.
I will actually take the battlefield. The story component here is like the king or the queen, the commander, or the general, like or like the champion, right? Goliath, Achilles actually take the field, and everybody knows that they have entered the fray.
Yeah, right. Like Achilles and Ajax, right? Or they didn't fight, did they? What's his name in Achilles' armor?
Patroclus.
That's right. But the idea here is when they wade into the fray of battle, they just leave a swath of destruction, right? Until they run into another champion who is also carving out their own swath of destruction. Mm-hmm. And then, like, they have to fight as a proxy for the rest of the army.
Right. Like, Achilles might get fireballed, but that doesn't matter. He's Achilles.
Yeah, exactly.
You didn't target his heel with that fireball, so...
And, like... Likewise, like, Achilles doesn't just get critted to death because 200 troops turn on him and all take one swing, right? Like, that doesn't happen. Like, once Achilles, who does he face off with?
Hector.
Once Achilles faces Hector, like, suddenly nobody is getting involved in that fight, right? Like, they basically form a big circle around him and start cheering them on.
Right.
As they fight as individuals, you know? Like... same thing like in Lord of the Rings, right? Like that opening scene where Sauron is like wading through the battlefield, like he just like kind of kills anything around him until that one brave soldier confronts him, and then it's the two of them fighting one-on-one in the midst of this massive 10,000 person battle.
Yeah, it is fine to hand wave rules here and be like, yes, those arrows definitely don't do anything to Sauron. You know, and right. It doesn't matter how many times you crit. And, you know, sometimes that's covered in the rules, like immune to non-magical weapons or whatever, right? But a moment like that should be impressive. And people probably actually do just shrink back when, like, the Dark Lord takes the field and only Isildur is the one who can, like, handle them in single combat.
I knew you knew his name.
Yeah. Yes, because he betrayed us all by not destroying the ring.
I think... If they're fighting as a proxy, right, like what happens is when a champion falls, usually the battle ends, mm-hmm. right? Or if the battle doesn't end, like the tides of battle turn significantly. And you can explain this in the game as like fate intervening to bolster the army or just like, you know, a massive morale swing. Like suddenly like troops that were overmatched are now just, you know, kind of inspired to do better. There could be like an magical or prophetical explanation for why this happens, but the point is when the champion falls, right? Like the battle is better for the side that wins.
Yeah, I kind of like the divine intervention that often shows up in these stories, like in the Trojan War, like the gods, like sort of pop in and out, right? They're like, oh no, actually, I don't want this person to die, and now I'm out, right? They don't stand around and start like slashing people with fiery swords. They're just like, I'm going to move this just a little bit over here. I'm going to turn this around.
Yeah, they're like managers in like a wrestling match.
Yeah, totally.
Like I can't directly influence the outcome, but I could just kind of like, you know, trip a guy maybe right before he does his big move.
Yeah. And you know, and then Venus is like, seems like they're going to lose. I'm going to get my family out of here.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so this is cool and it sounds like an awesome scrum, but where did the PCs actually fit into all of this?
So they could be commanders, mm-hmm. right? They could be directing the army and the different troop formations within the army, or they could each, you know, have some piece of the army that they control and they're responsible for the performance of that group.
Yeah, and this is going to be like a pretty skill-oriented piece of the session, because like just having one extra person with one extra sword isn't actually going to matter that much on the battlefield, no matter how good you are.
Right. Like I said, if a PC just wades into the battlefield in this framework, they just get critted to death by, you know, the first 20 attacks, one of them will be a crit and eventually you'll die.
Well, that's why I named myself Achilles.
Uh-huh. I think if you use this kind of framework, like you're highlighting the burden of command, right? Like having to make difficult decisions, having to command troops that are invariably going to die, like maybe sacrificing men for a greater purpose, right?
I would say be wary of letting some players sort of step back from this because they're saying, oh, my character isn't like a good general. There are always going to be reasons that they're sort of forced into a command position, or they may have like a special ability or skill or title that sort of requires them to be the one to take part in leading.
Right. We did this in Dynasty Unwarranted, right? Like on Gontalgrim, you were kind of forced to fix the problem of the local militia army so that they could win their battle against the orcs. So you all had to like go out and just fix problems in the army. And a lot of you ended up commanding from the front. Others were busy like sorting out logistics or whatever.
Which, you know, is command staff necessity.
Right. You might also find yourself as troops in the army. If you're low-level characters, like you could be part of a unit or like all, you know, six or four player characters might be like an elite unit themselves that operates as just them.
And as low-level characters, maybe this is Darwinian character creation. Like you are fighting and hopefully surviving and maybe are like one of the very few survivors and like that's why you're the party. Or right. It could be like, you know, you're all level three and everyone else is level one, and pretty quickly everybody else dies and now you are the ones remaining.
Right, and you've got to like complete some objective, like recover something or make sure that this like, you know, sacred ground is not defiled or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And here you want to like highlight the senselessness of battle and how chaotic it is and how war is hell, right? Like how as you advance, like a spell goes off and then suddenly the six men next to you are gone.
Hopefully people that you just had a nice conversation with.
Right. Ideally, you set them up that way.
Yeah.
Oh, they have families. They have names. They had names.
And hey, you are the ones who came up with those names.
Right.
And we've alluded to this before, but the party could just be sent on a special mission, right? While the battle is raging and all of this is going on around them, the party needs to do something else very important.
So I think this works better if you have kind of mid-level characters, right? Where the battle is a backdrop for what is otherwise, like, mostly a typical adventure, right? Like, you know, something needs to be done near the battle, but not actually as part of the battle, right? Like maybe that's an assassination, or maybe that's like stealing something or kidnapping somebody, right? It could be, you know, setting off like an avalanche that will trap the enemy troops, something like that. But the idea being like you're highlighting that the fate of a nation or the fate of this whole collective of an army is in the hands of just a few brave individuals.
You're right. These small people are going to have a major impact. You can even do this in the middle of the scrum, where part of the combat is them wading through this like war is hell, like troops on the ground battle, and, you know, taking like random damage here and there, and like there's no real way to predict how well they're going to be faring when they come out of the other side, or whether all the equipment they've brought with them is still going to be functioning. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they get to like the clearing where space has been made because like the war truck has killed everybody near it, and like they're the ones who have to sabotage it or stop it somehow.
Yeah, or like this happens when, especially when you get like you said, Geek the Mage, right? Like those mages are killing us. Like, we cannot survive this if somebody doesn't get to those mages. Like, you, party, go. Like, kill that mage. Let us win the day, right? Like, that sort of stuff. Just small things like that can have major impacts on the battle.
And then players can be like, oh, I know how to do this.
Yeah, I was born for this. I thought you'd never ask.
Yeah, in addition to the mage, it could just be the other champion, right? You're the only ones who even have a chance of like stopping this Goliath over here, or this Colossus, or whatever it is, whatever it might be.
I mean, you might just be the champions yourselves, right? Like, you could literally be like known characters within your army that are there to like ensure that you win, and you have to wade into the battle, find your foe, and like win it by proxy for your army.
This works best if the characters are high level, and it's a nice way to include them in these like scrum battles, because at this point, you know, whatever, level 17 D&D characters aren't going to be felled by like conventional weaponry.
Right.
But you do want to make sure that you're highlighting the awesome power of not only the opponent, right? Because it should be terrifying and there should be trepidation on the part of the party. But the PCs also need a chance to shine in this moment. Like, they're the only ones who can go out there. The regular troops, the line troops, and even like hardened veterans are looking at them maybe with a sense of awe or even fear and being like, how are you even doing this?
Yeah, I mean, like, the 4th edition Mook rule was perfect for this, right? Of like, cool, like, it doesn't matter what this enemy soldier looks like, you cut them down with one hit point, right? Like, that's it to you. Like, they're nothing. But when you approach this champion, and it might be like kind of like you, right? It could be the, you know, 3 Nazgul as opposed to, you know, 6 PCs or whatever, or it could actually be like kind of a series of one-on-one type fights. Like, whatever you do, when you face them, you are on equal footing now, right? Or maybe even just a little disadvantaged, but like the power that you wield is like unfathomable to the thousands of people around you. Which, I mean, I think is fair. You know, you get to like 17th level, like that is pretty unfathomable everywhere except for Forgotten Realms.
I mean, yeah, you're basically demigods walking the earth.
Yeah, exactly. Like, live it up a little bit, you know?
So I think in almost any campaign, you can find some time where there is going to be warfare. Like, I'm thinking about almost every party that I have played in or like run through an adventure, they have made decisions that probably will cause a war. Like, this is actually kind of like a good 1 or 2 sessions to have after they have completely screwed up diplomatic negotiations.
Yeah, right. Like, cool, we march for war. You're marching with us.
Yep. Like, at the like, front.
You made your bed, time to lie in it. I specifically didn't want to talk about mass combat rules, right? Because I don't think mass combat rules are actually all that important to like making warfare feel like visceral and feel like important in an RPG. Like, this is about like, what are you trying to get fictionally out of your warfare, right? Not how you resolve the like the ones and the plus ones and plus twos of like this type of troop versus this type of troop.
Yeah, mostly here that won't matter. Probably the most important thing you're doing here is giving a speech.
Yeah,
and exactly. Making some tactical decisions.
Or maybe casting a few spells.
Right.
All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
It's just fireball after fireball. It's a fireball Gatling gun. Wow, this is definitely going to turn the tide of the war.
Well, then it's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge and find out which regiment's coming up next to die in the meat grinder. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes.
Are you looking for a great story? Do you love Star Wars? Do you like podcasts?
If you said yes to any of these, check out the Redemption Podcast.
Well, I have less in my head than you do normally, probably.
You haven't met the crew I'm with. Pretty much everywhere we go, our life is in danger.
Things didn't explode. That's pretty sneaky for us.
That sounds horrible.
Yes, please finish up whatever underhanded thing you're doing on the computer terminals at the Jedi Temple.
Check out Redemption Podcast at www.redemptionpodcast.com.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building a character very appropriate for fantasy warfare. It is the Field General.
Uh-huh.
So what does the Field General do, Shane?
So the Field General leads the battle, but, you know, like we talked about, like, you got to be kind of close to things to make sure you keep your finger on the pulse. So the Field General is there to lead more from the front. Might be on horseback, might be on foot, but the point is, like, making sure that the troops immediately around him are doing their absolute best.
So, in the command tent, at first, making the decisions, and then takes the battle themselves.
Yeah, I think that's important, is that they are a commander and a leader of the men themselves, right? They aren't necessarily the leader of a grand army. They're responsible for making sure, like, these regiments, these companies do their jobs.
Oh, this is the general who's like, I don't want a promotion. That takes me away from my troops.
This is the colonel, really, is where we're at here. Like, you have a an infantry command responsibility.
Yeah. All right, so what's the build?
So the build is Battlemaster Fighter 16, Mastermind Rogue 3, Ranger 1.
I like this one. So from Fighter, you'll get a fighting style, defense or protection, up to you, second wind, and action surge.
You will also get combat superiority, which is what we're here for. We're going to take the martial adept feat, which will give us some extra maneuvers and an additional superiority die. You will end up getting 7 D10 superiority dice. For a while, you'll have some D8s and the D6, and then at level 10, that will become a D10.
I mean, with your 3 attacks per round, you can chew through those superiority dice very quickly.
Oh, yeah. You will also know 11 maneuvers out of the 16 possible maneuvers, but you're mostly here for Commander Strike, which, of course, lets you enable another character to make an attack with their reaction. Great for helping rogues or anybody who smites. And then also you're here for Rally, which will give temp HP to your allies.
Mm-hmm. You'll get 6 ASIs, one of which you'll use to take the Martial Adept feat. And then you'll also take Inspiring Leader, which lets you start everyone off who's listening to you with some temp HP when they hear your rousing speech.
And then at level 7, you get Know Your Enemy. And we talked a little bit about, like, champions, right? Like, I think this is how you size up your enemy generals as well as your enemy champions. Like, you look across the battlefield and you see, like, what is the make of that man or woman that opposes you? Literally, in this case, you'll know how many hit points they have. And if they have any fighter levels, what their CR is.
Yeah, this is the scene where, you know, the general is sitting astride a horse and pulls out the spyglass. You know, and like scans the troops, and then, wait a minute, what's that? Oh, who's that? A giant or this other person astride a horse? What do I know them from their armor or the way that they carry themselves?
Right. And the rule says you have to observe them outside of combat. I think if they're fighting far away on the battlefield and you're not in that combat, that should count well enough.
Yeah, totally. So from 3 levels of Mastermind Rogue, we'll get Expertise. You'll want Persuasion, Intimidation, maybe History. You'll get a little bit of Sneak Attack. And Master of Intrigue gives you proficiencies in the Disguise Kit, and the Forgery Kit, and Gaming Tool. This is great for co-intel. I like the idea that you're also a little bit of a scout. You know, the night before the battle, you're like, I'm going to either venture into town or maybe even infiltrate the enemy camp and see what I can find out.
Yeah, that turned out great for Stonewall Jackson, huh?
Well, he was fighting on the wrong side, so I think things turned out great for Stonewall Jackson.
Well, but not for him.
No, not so much.
You can also mimic speech, another kind of like we said, you know, like magic mouth and things like that, where you can boom out the voice of the enemy commander. That's handy.
Nice.
And then what you're really here for is Master of Tactics. So what you don't have a great use for as a Battlemaster is your bonus action if you aren't two-weapon fighting. So instead, we will take Master of Tactics, which lets you use your bonus action to help an ally from 30 feet away, which is why, of course, you lead from the front.
You lead from within several yards.
Exactly.
And then from one level of Ranger, you get Favorite Enemy. You're going to take 2 kinds of humanoids, and those will be whatever humanoids are the majority of the rival nations that you expect to face.
Yeah, that might be goblins and orcs, or it might be, you know, like actually humans. Mm-hmm. I think if it's all humans, you probably like pick 2 nations, right? Something like that, like in a like a birthright.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that should be fine with a GM. Hey, there isn't another race for me to pick. Give me something else.
And then what we're really here for is Natural Explorer. So you'll take your local terrain for this, probably grassland. But this gives you expertise in intelligence and wisdom skills related to your favored terrain. But more importantly, it makes it easier for your groups to travel, to forage, to track enemies in your favored terrain. You can't get lost, things like that. So very useful for an army on the march. If you're able to move a little bit faster and also aren't at risk of like screwing anything up because your field general is an expert in the terrain.
Right. And, you know, change your terrain depending on exactly what you expect, right? Dark Sun, take desert. If you're dwarves, fighting goblins, then you'll probably take mountains. If you're a Viking, take tundra.
Right, exactly. So in terms of leveling order, we always start Rogue One. Then I think you go 11 levels of fighter. Like, go ahead, get that third attack. And then finish your rogue, finish your fighter. And then I think that natural explorer is just a nice capstone for this build. So finish off ranger. So, Ishan, who is your field general?
My field general chooses as her natural explorer terrain, swampland. And so she is an unconventional general in that she rallies her troops through, you know, subterfuge and camouflage, and keeps them alive and, you know, happy, and keeps morale high even in like these bleak and sort of dismal surroundings where you're basically eking out a living. And then, you know, marshals them to gather right at the tree line, and when the enemy approaches, they charge suddenly onto the field with a quick hit, not like quick hit sorties of like skirmishing squads, but like a quick hit army who rushes in, finishes the combat quickly, and then just disappears back into the swamp.
That's definitely a thing. 2,000 troops marching quickly and quietly. I get it.
Well, you know, well, you're here with your level one ranger.
Right.
All right. What about your field general?
Pirate captain.
Oh, that works for me.
Yep. So well suited to life on the deck of a ship, I think. We'll take favorite enemy. We'll be like at probably swamp or is sea. Is that actually
coast? Yeah, coast.
Yeah, so we'll take coast for our natural explorer. But I think a field general on a ship makes a lot of sense, especially like, you know, like you need to rally and inspire your troops, but when you board, you need to be like all business. You need to like naval battles and naval attacks are actually hours long affairs, so you've got plenty of time to kind of like get the measure of practically every man on the other ship, right? Like you can almost measure up a ship to see like what their crew is like, right? And pick your targets that way. But I really like this build as like, you know, a rogue with just a little bit too much like charm and not quite enough ready to go stick you with a sword. Yeah. I think that works really well for this.
Right. Okay. Boarding party. Yep. This is necessary.
Yep. And I'm leading from the front. Or actually, I'm shouting across the gap. All right. Before we wrap up, we want to take a moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah. Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We are continuing our series on using iconic monsters, and we are talking about how to use devils.
And in the Character Creation Forge,
we're building the Fiend Slayer.
Well, that's it for episode 233 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
Total Party Thrill is brought to you by D&D Beyond. D&D Beyond is the official digital toolset and game companion for Dungeons & Dragons.
You can use it to build characters, track campaigns, run adventures, and do so much more.
You should have been building a whole bunch of homebrew stuff.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, well, for Dark Sun. So, like, we've gotten some benefits from being members of our mercenary company, some magical benefits, and I've built them all as items that we can share across our campaign, so everybody can pick like their plus one to a stat or, you know, like their epic boon.
I like this mechanically because like Angelo, who's running the Dark Sun game, doesn't have a D&D Beyond account. He's just one of the people that we have said plays a character in our campaigns. And right. So you just build the thing and like everyone can now still use it in the Dark Sun game, even though neither of us is running that campaign.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, so you don't have to just take the plus two strength epic boon. You can be like Khalid Maz Fury if you'd like.
Yeah, I dig it.
So I did it. There's also lots of awesome content available for free, like the D&D basic rules and articles from writers like James J. Heck and videos from Todd Kenrick.
And the team is always updating the site with new features, so improvements are always coming. So if that sounds interesting to you, check it out at dndbeyond.com.